Hello, friends. This is Bob Friedland. I am the host of this podcast, John Kerry for President 2008. And this is the podcast companion to the blog of the same name. And you can find my blog at http://kerryforpresident2008.blogspot.com. As I like to point out, this is my individual blog. The opinions expressed here are mine. They're not the opinions necessarily of Senator John Kerry, the Democratic Party, or any other organization. This podcast is supported only by me. I wanted to talk this afternoon. It's July 8th. It's 2:30 out here in Wisconsin. It's a rainy Wisconsin summer afternoon, and it's a good afternoon for a podcast. And what I'd like to do is share with you two comments that I've read, two columns or commentaries that I've read that I think are worthy of your attention. Not specifically about Senator Kerry or any presidential campaign, but a sense that something is basically wrong about the direction this nation is heading. Something is basically un-American about some political views that are being expressed about what America is all about. And I want to direct you to the first piece by Ira Chernus on Mother Jones. And I think if you get Mother Jones online and look for the July 7th column by Ira Chernus, you'll find this column. And it's really worthy of a good read. Let me try to excerpt it a little bit and see what you think. The big point in the name of this particular column is Karl Rove's Scheherazade strategy. Now, Scheherazade was the woman who told the stories, as I understand it, from 1001 Nights. And it's this Iranian storybook, the maiden whose husband's policy was wed him, bed him, and kill him at dawn. Now, according to Chernus, Rove is telling Republican candidates to follow Scheherazade's rule. When policy dooms you, start telling stories. Stories so fabulous, so gripping, so spellbinding that the king, or in this case the American citizen who theoretically rules our country, forgets all about a lethal policy. And I'm going to quote Chernus again. He says, the GOP stories are the same ones white people have been telling each other ever since they first set foot on North American shores. If you want to be safe, go to the frontier and wipe out the Indians. As former State Department official John Brown has noted, our Indian wars are not over yet. And Chernus points out that the President and Rove are trying to sell Iraq as a frontier conflict, too. They want to see U.S. troops as the cavalry putting down the Indians, or better yet, as pioneers creating small enclaves of civilization. In Iraq, they're called green zones, in the midst of a vast wilderness full of savages. What strength, what courage it takes to survive, but they have a job to do. They must teach the savages how to be free, and above all, like their pioneering forebears, they must have the guts to stick it out until the job is done. It's an interesting story, isn't it? And Chernus goes on to ask, how do we know our military in Iraq has such beneficent motives? The answer is simple. They are Americans, by definition, the heroes, the good guys. Every time they kill a bad guy like Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, they only prove once again what good guys they are. And he points out that a Washington Post ABC poll, 68% of Americans said the U.S. war against Iraq has, quote, helped to improve the lives of the Iraqi people, unquote. And as he kind of puts out, and I quote again, naturally they hope one day to be able to go home to their loved ones and live the peaceable lives they long for, but they aren't quitters like those democratic school marms back east in the halls of Congress. They are real frontiersmen with the will and the resolve to stay the course. They won't be scared off by suffering or bloodshed. Sometimes, let's be honest, it takes bloodshed for life to get better. Now he goes on to talk about the Republican fairy tales of heroic masculinity. And George W. Bush laid out at one campaign fundraiser, and this is a quote from George W. Bush, quote, "There's an almighty, a great gift of the almighty is freedom for every man, woman, and child. The American people expect the government to protect them. It's our most important job. Iraq is now the central front, and we've got a plan to succeed. There's a group in the opposition party who are willing to retreat before the mission is done. They're willing to wave the white flag of surrender. And there, my friends, as Chernow points out, is the real choice we're being offered by Rovian rhetoric. Weak-willed, cowardly Democrats against Republicans who tough it out, whatever the cost, because above all, they are real men." You know, and as he points out, and I'm quoting all over the place, but he says it better than I can, and I quote, "The urge to prove manhood is central to the story. It may be what got us into Iraq in the first place. For four decades now, neoconservatives have bewailed the feminization of America, a nation where women can wear suits and men can have long flowing hair, even in corporate suites, drives them crazy. Since the 1970s, they've touted belligerent policies, swaggering talk, and massive military budgets as the only way to stop liberals from imposing spinelessness on the nation. The neocons want to turn a nation of soft, lazy, mall-shopping, morally squishy relativists back to the manly, strenuous life that Theodore Roosevelt and Ronald Reagan preached. That's one big reason they work so hard to send our boys and girls off to the battlefields of Iraq. Karl Rove himself may not be a neocon, but he's betting that the voters will be mesmerized by John Wayne-style tales of real men fighting evil on the frontier. At least enough Americans to avoid the death sentence that the voters might otherwise pronounce on the party that brought us the disaster in Iraq." And he points out, goes further, that the frontier tales may sound trite and hackneyed to some, but they won't go away. You probably know them by heart. In fact, without a second thought, you probably put them together intuitively and unconsciously to form a single, unified narrative doing the Republicans' work for them. Many of your fellow Americans still take that grand narrative as the tried and true tale about the virtues that made America great. Now, I'm going to skip a little bit and point out, he continues with this comment, "This gets us to the heart of the Scheherazade strategy. It plays on the insecurity of Americans who feel that their lives are out of control. Karl Rove knows that, as Gary Bauer, religious right politico, once put it, Joe Sixpack doesn't understand why the world and his culture are changing and why he doesn't have a say in it. So Rove constantly invents simplistic good-against-evil stories for his candidate to tell. He tries to turn every election into a moral drama, a contest of Republican moral clarity versus Democratic moral confusion." Now, he concludes, "The Scheherazade strategy is a great scam built on the illusion that simple moralistic tales can make us feel secure, no matter what's actually going on out here in the world. Though it never fulfills its promise, too many Americans keep on falling for it. Why? Here are some clues from scholars who trace it back to the roots in American Christianity. Catherine Albanese of the University of California at Santa Barbara writes, "Ordered conduct of foreign policy will, according to the conservative ethic, keep evil at bay and erect the safeguards that protect Christian life. Thus, containment for conservative means the management of evil. But the management of evil is a lifetime task. far from relieving anxiety, is bound to create more of it, and Rove assumedly hopes more people who crave the manly certitude that is supposed to relieve anxiety. And go on, and this is Princeton's John Wilson, points out, from the Puritans to the present, people bent on controlling their lives have been haunted by the inescapable fear that they might lose that very control. It's difficult. The Republican Sherazades say, in effect, according to, again to the column, things may seem out of control now, but they're bound to be far worse under the Democrats, who are completely incapable of keeping our fragile lives sheltered from the winds of violent change. They tell the old familiar tales to plant seeds of doubt, to send the voter into the booth asking one big question: even if the Republicans are obviously not in control of this perilous world, do I dare to take a chance on those weak-kneed, flip-flop Democrats? If a vote against the Democrats means a vote against uncontrollable change, then Republicans are likely to have another election in their pockets. Now, the Republican success, as this author points out, quote, it also depends on voters letting fairy tales, not logical thinking about policy, determine their vote. Republicans should not assume that most voters will fall prey to alluring but absurd tales as the King and Scheherazade did. They can tell the voters and themselves a frontier story about another traditional American virtue, the courage to trust that ordinary people will use hard-headed common sense to separate fact from fiction. The old stories tell us that the actual pioneers, not the ones who so long inhabited our movie screens, had to confront life honestly. They couldn't afford to stay the course just for the sake of saving face, and they couldn't afford to play politics with the matters of life or death. When things went wrong, they're brave enough to admit it and use good old American ingenuity to set things right. They were true Democrats, expecting everyone to shoulder their share of responsibility and giving their neighbors the right to express their own opinion. They didn't call disagreement disloyalty. They knew that even the humblest guy or gal might have the best idea for fixing things. Out on the frontier, pioneers needed that kind of courage and common sense to make sure they and their families survived. And maybe just what the Democrats need to survive, too, trusting ordinary people, even Iraqis, to find practical solutions to practical problems. If the Republican candidates want to play Scheherazade, they have to recognize that the Democrats might have a more honest, compelling story to tell. And we, the voters, are the king. We get to decide who remains alive at dawn on November 9th and who ends up a political corpse. And that's how Ira Chernus, who's the religious studies at the University of Colorado at Boulder, wrote. He has a new book that's coming out, Monsters to Destroy, the Neoconservative War on Terror and Sin. I kind of read this and went, wow. You know, Lakoff talks about framing. And this is the great scam. This is a macho scam where things like family values are tossed around. And not a reality-based family value. Not a recognition that in America there's diversity. There are households that are led by two same-sex parents with children in them. But the macho man leading the household with the wife, father knows best kind of 1950s, 1960s reality that we long for, the security of that simple leave it to beaver home. So it's okay to bash homosexuals if you're part of that defending America. We vote for concealed carry and weapons everywhere. We fall for the National Rifle Association view that there should be no regulation of guns at all, and that the more guns everywhere, the better. Part of that Western macho Theodore Roosevelt idea that doesn't take into consideration that the proliferation of firearms across our society is dangerous, that Democrats have never said we should get rid of all guns and confiscate them. But it's the proliferation of guns that leads to dangerous events. They live in the simplistic world where stem cells are potential people. It's a fantasy world where these embryonic stem cells might become people instead of the reality that they're being thrown in the garbage, the reality that the cure for disease may involve using these cells instead of throwing them in the garbage. They live in the macho world of stay the course. Onward, onward into the valley of death. Keep going. Don't look to the side. Don't look to the right. Don't assess what you've done. And anybody that doesn't like it, well. They live in this naive world where we should regulate opinion, where we shouldn't have distasteful things being done in America because distasteful is uncomfortable, that it's distasteful to see a flag being burned. But let's mutilate the Constitution. Let's fool people about what really is going on. Let's chop up the First Amendment. Let's chop up the 14th Amendment. Let's make fun of federal bonds and say they're just pieces of paper, they're lousy IOUs, they don't mean anything. Let's break that part of the 14th Amendment. Let's break the equal protection of the 14th Amendment. Let's break the rules of habeas corpus. Let's break the rules of search and seizure. Let's not bother with search warrants because we're tough and we're on a fight. It's not the kind of America that's part of my dream. Oh, I think we should be tough, but we should live by the rule of law. It's not a big Western. Let's string them up. Somebody has committed a capital crime. Well, let's electrocute them. Let's inject drugs into their veins. Let's snuff them out. Let's hang them. Let's put them before a firing squad. Tough stuff. It's not civilized. But it's part of that macho image. Let's be tough and xenophobic. Let's say that America has to only to speak English and everybody else is a second-class citizen. Anybody that dissents is a traitor. That's not America. I want to share with you one other commentary that I received, I think it was yesterday, from Teacher Ken. And I really would like to do an interview with Teacher Ken here if I could. Ken regularly writes insightful commentary. Maybe I find it insightful because I agree with it. But he's a very thoughtful person. And he's disturbed about what's going on in America. Let me just read what he wrote verbatim. And let me finish up this podcast because I'll get my blood pressure too high if I get all riled up. And Ken writes calmly, and let me just quote him. And you can find this on Daily Kos. It's right now the top-rated diary by Teacher Ken, Ken Bernstein. And he writes, there's an expression that those of us in the Society of Friends will on occasion use, that we have the responsibility to speak truth to power. We also do not believe in oaths, and some will not even offer affirmations, because oaths and affirmations imply that absent these, we are not bound to speak only truth. I will speak truth as I know it, and let those who have ears hear. I will not remain silent while the constitutional underpinnings of our liberal democracy are undermined. I will not remain silent while the rights of others are denied. I will not remain silent while some are labeled in fashions to demean their humanity or to justify treatment that is inhuman. I will not remain silent when I encounter those who would divide people into us and them, whether they that be political opponents domestically or those who are called the enemy. I will not remain silent in the presence of those who seek partisan or personal advantage in manipulating elections, courts, laws, and regulations. I will not remain silent in the presence of those who... Excuse me, I will not remain silent when racist, sexist, homophobic, anti-Catholic, anti-Christian, anti-Muslim, anti-Semitic, or demeaning language of any kind is used towards any other human being. I will not remain silent when I encounter those who justify a particular course of action when they do it, but condemn it when done by someone whom they deem as their opponent. I will not remain silent at rationalization of selfishness. I will not remain silent at the destruction of the environment or any part thereof. It is the common heritage of all humanity. I will not remain silent when destruction of lives and property in other countries is justified on the basis that it is our national self-interest, or that it is better to fight them over there than over here. And I will certainly not remain silent when people argue that it is better to keep quiet now in order to win an election and or achieve power at some future point. How can I explain that to those whose lives, families, homes, freedom are destroyed or lost in the interim? I cannot assume that my choosing to speak, to no longer remain silent, will be affirmed. I must expect that others will criticize, condemn, and reject the words I speak, the actions I take. I know that I will be accused of exercising a judgment which is not mine to apply, or that I do not know all the facts. I will listen. I will attempt to understand what others have to say, what they express as their thoughts and motivations. I accept that we will not always agree, but that does not remove from me the moral responsibility to speak out when I encounter any wrong. I will not always speak in the same way. Sometimes public confrontation does not empower the person to easily change his mistaken ways, while a private encounter gives the space necessary. Sometimes phrasing my concerns in terms of a question may elicit a recognition by the person to whom the question is addressed of the need to change, or allow her to give me the information that allows me to understand that I have misunderstood or misperceived. Sometimes I will speak without words, by nod, or not laughing at a joke, thereby allowing the other person an opportunity to self-correct. If I have doubt, I will inquire. I know I can be wrong. But if I know, I cannot pretend that I do not know, that I do not understand, and if then I remain silent, I become complicit, that I will no longer be. I will speak out because I still can. I will write because perhaps some will read the words I offer. I will participate politically because that is part of speaking out. I am 60. I have had a life far richer in material benefits and in the opportunity to learn than the vast majority of people who have ever lived. If I die tomorrow, the measure of my life will not be how much I have consumed or accumulated. In my mind, if I could then look back, the measure will be how willing I was to stand up for others. This is not altruistic. But because what can be denied to others can be denied to me, and I do not hold myself out as thereby superior. This is quite selfish because I am affected, and it is not original in thought. Let me offer the words of Hillel from the Pirkei Avot. If I am not for myself, then who will be for me? And if I am only for myself, then what am I? And if not now, when? I am not willing to remain silent anymore. Thank you so much, Teacher Ken. I hope that my small voice can join yours and others will join in, that we can seek to have an America that is something we can continue to be proud of, something that is a beacon for other nations, for other peoples, that we can be an example of freedom, that we can be an example of tolerance, that we can be an example of caring for the environment, of taking care of the poor, of taking care of the disabled, of reaching out to those who have less than us, here in our country and around the world. We need to be able to be a force in the world for peace, and not a force that always wants to use the stick first. Thank you, and thank you all for bearing with me on this podcast. I'm truly an amateur podcaster. I feel like I have a lot to say, and probably there are many things I say that you've heard before, and other people have said it better. Well, this doesn't have much to do with John Kerry. It has everything to do with Senator Kerry. It has everything to do with where our nation is heading. If you have any comments or questions or would like to reach me, you can reach me at bobsadviceforstocks@lycos.com. If you have an MP3 or commentary you'd like me to include in the next podcast, you can record it and send it to me at bobsadviceforstocks@podomatic.com. If you have questions about setting up your own podcast, I'd be happy to help all of you. Thank you again, and good day.